Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I am Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie. And joining us, as he is kind enough to do every month, to take our questions and yours, is Governor Deval Patrick.
Kindness has nothing to do with it.
What is it about? Why do you keep reappearing here every single month?
It's Marjorie.
Why, thank you, Governor.
That's why I come Marjorie. Every
thank
day,
you, Governor.
Too.
It's Marjorie, yes. That's why it's always troubling when you're not here.
It is troubling when I'm not here.
Jim apparently never takes vacation.
Our number, by the way, in the governor's is 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970.
Hello to you both.
And as you know, it's good to see you, Governor. Welcome
good to
back
see you
from
too.
Asia. You can email us at bpr@wgbh.org. And as you know, whatever questions the governor does not answer during the hour he's here are forwarded to his office and his people will respond.
Yeah, we wanted to ask you all about Asia in just a couple of minutes. Mm-hmm. We thought we'd get some big news stories out of the way first. The first one, of course, is the 5-year-old Jeremiah Oliver from Fitchburg.
Yes.
The little boy who's missing and feared dead. The social worker and supervisor who was supposed to be protecting this little kid and his mm-hmm. siblings, they've been fired mm-hmm. Because the social worker didn't visit the child's home as she was supposed to. Mm-hmm. Now, you defended the head of the Department of Children and Families, said she shouldn't resign, but she should get to the bottom of this. But one of the issues is, as you know, Governor, is that this particular social worker, and this is not obviously to excuse her, but she did file 6 grievances since May about her caseload being overwhelming. This is one of the recurring themes that these social workers have supposed to have 15 cases and have 20 or more. Any news on this or any reaction to what's gone on since we last saw the stories in the paper?
So the, obviously I'm as concerned as you are, and I think any decent person is about Jeremiah and his whereabouts. Indeed, the older kids, the brother and sister, I'm worried about them too because I've been briefed on their condition and their experience. And without crossing a line into what is not public and won't be, I can tell you it's a pretty grisly story.
Yeah,
really troubling story, and a family that's been involved with DCF for a long time. The social work provided to the family up until the end of last year was exemplary. It was in a different office, a different social worker, a different different team. Really terrific. The problem, again, based on what I know so far. Seems to have been about the social worker who was fired from the office to which it was transferred, and her supervisor. And I'm going to hold my fire at that point because I've asked the commissioner to look into the question about whether responsibility goes beyond those two, and I have some reason to believe that it does. I can tell you that the question of people being overextended is a serious one.
Yeah,
but it's just a separate one. I mean, you can't be so busy that a family with these many 51 A's, you know, the emergency
right.
Petitions, isn't cause for you to raise the question with somebody. I'm not talking about a grievance. I'm talking about saying to somebody, we got a problem here, and I can't get to it because I'm too busy. That didn't happen. In fact, what happened is a representation was made in the summer last year, and you'll hear more about this soon, that the family was fine and was in a new apartment with brand new furniture, and that was not true because no one had actually gone to see that. Being busy doesn't explain that kind of thing away.
Yeah.
Speaker DeLeo was quoted, I think, in the Herald this morning, Governor, saying that he doesn't think there's a funding shortage at DCF, Department of Children and Families. Do you agree with him?
I think the Speaker would agree with me and with most people that their resources are strained. It's not unusual in state government these days. You know, we've reduced headcount by over 6,000 positions over the last several years. But, my point is that there are two serious issues here, but they are not connected in this case. That's all I'm saying. The issue of Jeremiah Oliver and his brother and sister and that family and their involvement with DCF is a very serious issue. It's being taken very seriously. It is very upsetting to me personally. But the question of caseload by DCF social workers is a separate one from this, also an important one. And I can I just say one other thing?
Sure.
You know, the social workers at DCF perform hundreds of miracles a day.
They do.
They do fabulous, fabulous work under really tough circumstances. That does not get noticed because it's kind of taken for granted. It's or whatever it is. It just doesn't get noticed. Once in a while, there is a horrible tragedy like this. And I got to tell you, they feel – that team feels as badly about this as – you and I do, and many of your listeners too, and we'll get to the bottom of it. And at the end of the day, I think folks will accept both inside and outside the agency the importance of there being swift and certain accountability.
Very quickly, just to tie this thing up, my understanding, and I want to confirm it, is one of the things you've ordered the commissioner there to do is to make sure that there are no other Jeremiah Oliver situations, meaning there are no other homes that are not being visited as
correct.
A is that what's going on right now?
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. And I should – can I just
– oh, sure, sure, sure.
Want to change the subject, but the child advocate, which was a position created by the legislature, an independent position created by the legislature a few years ago and very, very ably led by Judge Gail Garinger, is conducting a separate interview, systemic review. I said interview. I meant review of systems in that office and in DCF. Just as a kind of belts and suspenders here.
One last thing that's been in the news, and then we'll move on to other stuff. Your much younger cousin, well, not much, but he's younger, Reynolds Windersmith Jr. From Illinois, is one of several. What are you laughing
at? Is that bizarre or what?
Okay, well, let me just tell people who don't know
okay.
about this.
Okay.
He was one of several prisoners yeah. that had a very long sentence commuted. He's been in jail since 1994 yeah. by President Obama, citing a disparity in the sentencing for crack cocaine yeah. dealings. And I just want to make sure of a couple of things. What your office has said, you have no recollection of meeting this young guy yeah. who's 39 now. You weren't involved in any application for commutation, learned of it through the media reports. That's all correct?
That's all right.
But it's not unreasonable to think, and if I were this guy, I certainly would say, in all, because he's been the subject of a crusade by many young lawyers
and
by the ACLU, that you wouldn't put in there somewhere. I certainly would, that my cousin was the governor of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, and the White House might have known that. So did they alert you that he was on this list?
No.
No.
No, I would tell you, first of all, my I know this man exists.
Yep.
I didn't know of his involvement with the I didn't know of his imprisonment, but my uncle, my mother's brother, was himself a heroin addict and was in and out of the same tenement where I lived with my mom, my sister, and my grandparents from time to time. And he was married. He's passed away now. He was married at least three times that
he's
I know
He's the father of.
Of
this young
he's
guy.
He's the father, right. And he was married at least three times that I know of, or had families with three different women that I know of. I actually don't know whether he was actually married. There were two older boys who were around my age, and I was close to when I grew up. I'm not so much now. I think one of them has passed away. My sister told me that last night. The oldest had been involved in the criminal justice system as well, and I think is out now and living with his family, my sister says, in Virginia. And then there was, by another mother, a daughter who was a baby when, my sister and I were sort of, I want to say, 7 or 8 years old. And she lived with us, and we're very close. And she lives in Chicago, is married, and has a kid. She lived with us for a time. And then I left, remember, at 14.
To go to Milton County.
Go to Milton, and I was home from time to time through my time at Milton, but not much at all when I was in college. And somewhere in there, my uncle had another family. So I'm 20 years old thereabouts by the time this young man who's in the news today was born. and I have absolutely no memory of ever having met him.
Do you have any thought of contacting him now that he's allegedly going to be out come April? And
no,
by the way, for
so
those
no,
who
no,
don't,
I was, no, I was
sorry.
Let me go one step further because that my every once in a while Diane will get a a lottery card, I mean a lottery ticket or something like that. Like we do this, maybe you know people who do this. We get lottery tickets and put them in stockings. For the family. And every once in a while she'll get one. Every once in a while I'll get one. I said to her, you know what, Diane? If we ever win, no one will believe it wasn't rigged. So let's just accept that going in. So here's why this is particularly bizarre to me. I get an email while I'm away. I think it was Monday or Tuesday from my assistant Michelle, who has received an email from my sister, whom you've met, I think.
Yes.
My sister
Ronnie,
who lives in Milton, who has received an email from the cousin we were close to, who lived with us when we were kids, who lives in Chicago, about this kid, right?
Pre-commutation.
Yes, yes. This is like, you know, Tuesday or something like that. I'm on a flight on the way back. I read this email, and then yesterday, and then, you know, I don't do anything about it, but it has the ACLU kind of, you know.
Yeah, they've been involved.
You know,
they're trying to help him.
It has their kind of their
letterhead
paragraph worth of argument about
okay.
it. Anyway, I read this thing. I think, wow, that's amazing. And then yesterday, Brendan walks in and says, do you have a cousin named Reynolds Wintersmith? And I said, isn't that so weird? I just got this email, you know, the other day and blah, blah. He said, well, the president just commuted 8 sentences and one of them was your that's why I mentioned the thing about the lottery, because it felt as improbable as
so that. Do you intend to – I mean, he's out in April. The latest, they say, is April. Do you have any intention of – he is your first cousin. Any intention
I mean, I have no – I have no relationship with him. I'm not going to avoid him. I'll probably check in with the cousin I do know. Mm-hmm. And I think she may have a relationship with him. I'm not sure of that either.
Well, speaking of the ACLU, here's what he wrote on his ACLU post when he was involved in this effort of trying to get his sentence commuted, that he was raised in a crack and prostitution house where adult members of my family taught me how to cook, package, and sell cocaine. Both of my parents were drug addicts, and he found his mother dead from an overdose when he was 11.
Mm.
Now, you left to go to Milton when you were 14. This guy at 17 starts running a gang. You grew up with this family.
No. Don't confuse that. That's
what?
Not the same household I grew up
okay.
in.
Okay. No, I didn't mean you.
It's a different city.
I didn't mean you grew up with them. I mean,
yeah.
I mean this. You knew. What is amazing to me, what I'm trying to get at here, Governor, is you were the governor of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts.
Mm-hmm.
This guy, Sonny, was in your – this guy's father was in your house, your
mm-hmm.
mother's brother.
Mm-hmm.
You're the governor. He went into a gang
yeah.
and had crack cocaine problems. I mean, it's kind of like, how'd you get where you got? Is
there,
it your mom, your grandma?
But for the grace of God. You know, I wrote in my book, I write about briefly about Sonny and an unforgettable, for me, unforgettable encounter. Sonny was this young man's
father.
My uncle. And an unforgettable encounter between my mom and her brother one weekend when my grandparents were away and Sonny showed up to stay for a couple of days. And I walked in on him in the front room of the apartment shooting up, and I didn't know what he was doing. My mother was in the back. We had one of these sort of railroad apartments. The tenement was like that. And I went in the back and I asked my mother what was going on. I don't remember how old I was, maybe 9. I don't know. And my mother, instantly recognizing what this was about, flew into a rage and confronted my uncle, and they got into a screaming match, and then he left, I think with my grandparents' TV to hawk it. She then locked him out. So when he came back at night, you know, he's pounding on the door. We're in bed asleep, and she's double locked and bolted the door. He's pounding on the door to be let in, and you know, my sister and I are freaking out and scared to death, and my mother's just ignoring it and wouldn't let him in all night. My grandparents come back at the end of that weekend, and my grandmother chews out my mother for locking her brother out of the house. You know, no comment about the shooting up or stealing the TV. I mean, that was some of the dynamic in the place where I was raised. And ours wasn't the only house like that. But, I, you know, you've heard me talk about it before. We talked. You and I have talked about it before. I had the great blessing of having strong adults in the house and strong adults elsewhere in school and in church who paid attention to me and cared about me. And, you know, it's a it's something I feel thankful for every day.
That's the voice of Governor Deval Patrick. We have a lot more for him, but we figure since the lines have been full since the second he walked in, we should let him take some of your calls. Our number is 877-301-8970. Governor Patrick, all yours.
Okay,
let's go to the call. Sure.
Sure. Is it Rhea? Am I pronouncing it right, Rhea, from Maynard?
Rhea, is that how you pronounce it, Rhea?
Yes, it's Rhea.
Hi, Rhea. You're on with the governor.
Well, thanks for taking my call.
How are you?
I'm great.
Good.
I'm wondering, you must know about the other DSS case that's been in the news in the Globe this week, about the girl...
At Children's Hospital?
Yes, that case.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I'm really concerned about that one. I'm an adult with mitochondrial disease, which is the disease that she had originally been, was being treated for by a physician at Tufts.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, this physician has been 30 years in the field. He is renowned nationwide.
Mm.
And, you know, one of the things that really strikes me about the case and DCF's role in it is that they locked this child in a psychiatric ward for almost a year, and they took children's word at face value when children's gave her a different diagnosis from what Tufts gave her, and they never investigated the case. They never spoke. I mean, well, they did 10 months later. It took them 10 months to speak with her treating physician from Tufts. And they never contacted any of the teachers from her school or other adults that knew her.
Hey, Ray, I'm only going to interrupt you only because a huge number, even though we talked with Brian McGrory from the Globe about it the other day, people may not know. Tufts referred this girl to Children's Hospital, and then subsequently the things you described happened. And I believe there's supposed to be a ruling as early as today as to whether or not she will return to the parents. But is there a question for the governor, Rhea, in there somewhere?
Yes, and right before the question, if I could just say that this isn't the first case, that there have been several, and because you're the governor, I'm specifically honing in on DCF's role. You know, I don't understand how DCF could do this without any investigation, and I wonder if you could comment on that. And in general, what can be done to get both children's and DCF to start handling these cases differently?
Thank you, Rhea.
Thank you, Rhea. I've read about this case too, and I think it is also true and not surprising that there is more to the story than even in the very thorough reporting that I have read and Rhea that you've read about. It's you know, as a parent, it's troubling. It's worrisome. You know, we all know parents who's you know, we think we are the reasonable parent, but we also know parents who are less so, and where there's more to that story, where those still waters run deep. So I don't want to comment on that particular case because I think there are layers of it, and it's being it is being reviewed and being ruled on independently, Jim, as you said. But I think the question of the larger question is, what is a state agency charged with care and protection of children supposed to do in a gray area, in those delicate areas? You know, there's a view out there in some circles that a child is better under the care of his or her mother or dad. Even if mom and dad are living in a shoebox. And there's another view out there that says that that the state should the DCF through the state through DCF should exercise should be interventionist in a way because you never – because you always want to err on the side of – on the conservative side, if you will, and not risk the kind of thing, you know, that happened in the case of Jeremiah or that may have happened in the case of Jeremiah, certainly his brother and sister. And I think that every day social workers are trying to find what the right place is in between. I don't think there's a there is a pattern here, with due respect to Rhea's point, but it's certainly a question I'm asking as well as a result of that article. And you, and can I also say, and I know I'm going on too
long. No, you are not at all.
Rhea was made the point that the doctor at Tufts was a nationally renowned physician in his field. And he is he has a competing view from another nationally renowned a group of physicians. And, you know, frankly, I'm not in a position to make that call. And I think the question is, who is in the position to make that call when that call has to be made?
Let's go back to the phones. That's voice of Governor Deval Patrick.
Sure.
Governor.
Lee is calling from Worcester. Lee, you there?
Hi, Lee.
Thank you. How are you?
Great.
Thanks for
Thank
holding.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Welcome home.
Thank you.
First, let me say, I hope they find Jeremiah safe and sound.
Yes. Pray
Governor,
for that.
Governor, I am a former Protective Services with DCF. I recently retired after over 30 years.
Wow.
Congratulations.
Thank you for your service.
Tough job, but there's a rewarding experience because there are more successful stories than not.
That's what I said a minute ago.
Yeah, there are.
You know? Yeah. My question is this. The department has what they call monthly ticklers. These are computerized forms.
Yeah.
And they report a worker's performance of home visits each and every month.
Yep.
And if the worker does not perform, then the supervisor, the area program manager, and the area director call the social worker in and they have a meeting.
Right.
And at times they can put the social worker on what they call a work plan.
Mm-hmm.
And if things don't improve, then it gets bumped up.
Mm-hmm.
Getting straight to my question, along with concern, is when a tragedy, and this has not even been become a tragedy yet, and I hope it's not a tragedy.
Mm-hmm.
However, when a case such as this comes to the forefront,
mm-hmm.
it's always the social worker and the supervisor who take the hit, and it stops right there.
Mm-hmm.
In, as you know, large corporations, there's a chain of command, and it certainly would, you know, continue up.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it falls with other people up above mm-hmm. that give the directive. And, of course, direct staff are to follow those requirements.
Mm-hmm.
And if not, it's up to the chain of command to be aware of such
mm-hmm.
things,
mm-hmm.
especially. It's inexcusable if it's gone on for 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And the other concern that I have...
Hey, Lee, I'm sorry to interrupt, only if I can, because there's so many people on the line. Do you have a question for the governor about,
well, the tickler,
based on your experience?
The tickler.
Yeah.
The tickler. So
yeah.
Was anyone looking at that tickler? And I know because confidentiality matters. I know, you know you're kind of tied here. That's my concern, the tickler. Where was the tickler and where was the area program manager along with the rest of the people up the chain of command?
So, Lee... I'm sorry. Excuse me.
They should have known that these visits were not occurring.
I'm sorry.
No,
Lee
is her name, yeah.
Yeah, so Lee, I have learned in the last few days about that system, the tickler system. Mm-hmm. There's another term you guys use for it, though, but I know what you mean. And the questions I have asked are about responsibility up the chain. I have some of those answers. But I can't talk about them right now. You're going to hear about them in the next little while, because there are a couple more questions we want to get to the bottom of and we want to give people a chance to answer to, you know, beyond the tickler, to explain the discrepancies to the extent they exist between the procedures and expectations and what the ticklers say. I think we're asking the same questions, Lee, that you are asking, and we're following that that trail. I guess I would just say one other thing. When Lee says, let's not call this a tragedy yet, it's already a tragedy. I think what she means is let's hope for the best for Jeremiah.
He's alive. Yeah.
Yes, indeed. And that he's found and that he's safe. But knowing what I know about the treatment of the other two children we are and what might have been prevented, it's already a tragedy.
Yeah, these two other kids complained to their teachers, and thank goodness for the teachers, that they had been beaten and abused by the mother and the boyfriend.
Let me say that the 51A petitions, they didn't start in November. They go—
51A being what, Governor?
And these are the emergency—
abuse and neglect.
Abuse and neglect.
You're required to file if you think a child is being abused or neglected.
Can we? And the range of places, the range of sources of those complaints is just stunning. It's so sad.
We're going to take a brief break. The governor's with us until the bottom of the hour for our questions and yours. The number to get to him is 877-301-8970. Give us a call. Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. This is Ask the Governor. That's the 1 hour a month when the governor comes into our studio and talks to us and talks to you. You can get to him at 877-301-8970. Governor, before we get back to the calls, in the spirit of full disclosure, as I always say to Marjorie, a spirit I rarely embrace, I am one of those people who used to rail against chief executives of states going on foreign missions, allegedly to bring business back to their state or have this business flow back and forth. You just got back from 10 days in Asia. I've been reading a lot about it. What came out of this? What was the benefit for the people of Massachusetts?
Well, a couple things. I mean, there are a couple of hard deals that were signed and announced while we were there. Actually, one of them goes back to Israel. A company we—
Where you were not so long.
Right, exactly. On another trade mission where we met an entrepreneur in the water innovation space. He moved his company here to Massachusetts, and he signed a joint venture with a Japanese company when we were together in Japan last week. We have an energy efficiency company from Massachusetts that signed a joint venture with a Japanese company. Then we've been cultivating these things before the trip, so it wasn't like it happened over coffee while we were— while we were there. We met some extraordinary folks in the transportation space, one of whom had shown some interest in taking the commuter rail contract. Remember that was bid recently?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And is one of the best, one of the most highly respected operators in the world. And they withdrew before they actually made a bid. And I was really keen to talk with them about why. And I think as we talk with them, there may be some opportunities to think in fresh ways about how they could help us get our system right and better functioning. We met with a potential manufacturer of the T and Orange Line, the Red and Orange Line contract that we're putting out for new cars, who expressed some interest as a condition of that contract in actually building them in Massachusetts, which would be, you know, something we're very interested in. And otherwise, we met with folks in those companion or compatible innovation sectors that are the high growth sectors here. And in the case of they were a little different in each place. So in Japan, we focused mainly on biotech, high tech, and clean tech. In Hong Kong, we focused on financial services because Hong Kong is, as you may know, really important financial services gateway in Asia. And in Singapore, we focus mainly on the water tech folks, but also biotech and clean tech generally. And it was really useful. And, you know, I've told you before, the nature of business today is not that you take a trip and you come back with a fistful of purchase orders for widgets. You come back with relationships. You open doors. And then you see whether businesses will walk through them. If you look back at the report that was released on the Israel trade mission right before we left, which was, 2.5 years ago, I want to say, maybe, and it was a look back on what the economic benefits were from that mission. They were pretty darn powerful, but it took time for people to, you know, make the most of relationships we had either freshly made or renewed.
Very quickly, since you mentioned transportation and subway cars and those sort of things, very quickly, one, we're going to get late night tea service. Apparently,
yes.
You found money for that thing. And if you want any thoughts on that, it's fine. Marty Walsh, I was talking to, interviewing the other night, and he said he likes to think that his advocacy for it helped push this thing along. I'd like to know if it had any impact.
Well, he's the mayor-elect, so the answer to that is
of course it is. And secondly, this question is really for Marjorie. Are we going to have a third bridge going to Cape Cod?
Isn't that interesting? On the late night tea service, you know, I knew it was a good idea. We'd heard a lot about it when we were doing the work to get the transportation finance plan ready, the transportation plan, and then the way to finance it. And so it was in the proposal we made at the beginning of the year, and we heard a lot about it from, you know, not just the hipsters who want to stay out late on a weeknight. But from, you know, hospitals who have a third shift and what have you. And we didn't feel enough resources in what the legislature ultimately did to assure we could sustain it for more than, you know, Friday and Saturday night on a trial basis. And we're looking for ways to get some support from businesses to help us sustain it beyond this trial basis.
And universities,
and learn
potentially,
from,
Rich
yes,
Davey told us.
Exactly. But the response has been off the charts.
Yeah.
The excitement about it from merchants, from young people, from workers, from all sorts of folks, really, really excited about it. And Boston's a pretty fun town. There's some safety issues that I think are made better by having access to the T. So that's really, really good news. I wanted to say, Marjorie, you'd be interested. We have been – so one of the things that the legislature gave us was the latitude to think more broadly about public-private partnerships as a way to – meaning are there private investors you can bring in to help fund public transportation projects? There are not many very good models in the United States.
Well, there's New Balance, though, down the block that's doing the commuter rail thing, correct?
Right. There are not many successful models in the United States. There are many, or there are more of them outside the United States. And we met with one entity that may be interested in investing in a bridge in that third bridge for the purpose of having, you know, for the purpose of seeing, of trying to test this idea. I don't get ahead of me. And, Rich is somewhere listening to this saying, oh, God.
Your secretary.
Yes, Secretary Davey. But, there are funders in that part of the world who are interested in us and interested in this kind of thing, and that was one of the reasons why he was along on the.
So for example, because there's some roads in this country, not many, that have that relationship. They're built by a private entity, and then they take the toll. So the theory, I don't want to get too far ahead of you either, but the theory would be they invest in this third bridge to Cape Cod, and the tolls would go to them. Is that the theory?
Well, there are a couple different ways of doing it. So I'm not going to suggest that's the only way. The model, a model in the United States, is the. The Skyway in Chicago, mm-hmm. which I can't remember whether it was the mayor or former governor who basically sold it and collect – the Skyway in Chicago was a toll road and sold it and then took the proceeds and used them for operating funds. That's why I say that's not a very successful model, right? You take the funds, you put it into new capital, you pay down debt, right? You want to treat that kind of transaction that way, but there are a couple different models. That we met this unbelievable operator of the Hong Kong subway and rail system. They don't do the buses, but they manage the the subway, the commuter rail, and then the high-speed rail, which is intercity.
It's embarrassing in a way that we're so behind some of these other places.
Well, you know, they have now in effect privatized it. I mean, it's the government is a shareholder in that company, because the way the deal was done was that the debt was given to the company too, and in exchange for the, not given but acquired by the company, in exchange for that, the government gets a seat on the board and shares in the company. And their margin for lateness of trains is like is measured in seconds. It's not measured in minutes. It's an extraordinary model, but it's not a transportation only model. It's basically a real estate company, right? Because what they do is they build malls and hotels and office buildings on the land where the stations go, which is owned by this company. And that financial model funds the transportation. It's a very, very intriguing model, and very, it'd be very, a very new model in the United States.
Okay, let's go back to the phones.
Sorry,
Governor Pat. No. It's up to you.
Sort
Take
of
it away.
Top of mind these days. Charles is calling from Falmouth. Charles, thank you for holding.
Thank you, Governor, for taking my call.
Sure.
I'd like to ask for your assurance that those who would be losing their unsubsidized individual health care coverage under the Commonwealth Choice Program will not lose all 2014 coverage at great financial risk through no fault of their own on January 1st if the re-enrollment backlog at the Health Connector, which is reportedly 42,000 people, remains after Monday's deadline. And specifically, I'm asking whether you can ensure that those who are paying the full freight at least whatever extension is needed to work through whatever backlog remains on Monday.
Yep. I feel pretty good about this. We've obviously been working on it, Charles, and it sounds like you're very informed. Maybe for the folks who don't know what we're talking about. So, Charles, just let me indulge me just a second for those who may not be as deeply into it as you are.
Sure.
There are two different deadlines that we have to meet. One is the transfer of folks who have been on our own health reform to the ACA qualified programs. And we also have to pick up the relatively small number of people who have not been insured even under our own health reform. And we have two different deadlines for this. One is January 1, and the other is at the end of March. And the reason I think Charles is asking the question is because we have had similar website issues as the national exchanges, the federal exchanges, and we've had to do a whole bunch of workarounds. Been very disappointing performance by our vendor, by the way.
Is this CGI?
Yeah, I'll come. Yeah, we can talk about that another day. But we've done a number of workarounds, and Charles, I feel pretty good. Everybody's going to be okay. I have asked people, I've urged people, I've instructed them to keep their eye on the ball. The ball, in my view, is not just about having a functioning website. It's making sure people are insured and that they don't have a gap in their insurance, which is what your question is about. And as a matter of fact, I'm going to be speaking with Secretary Sebelius at HHS in Washington a little later today on this as well. There's one more workaround that I think is to use a phrase again I used earlier, kind of a belt and suspenders approach, and I need her to bless that, and I think she will, and you and others who have these concerns will be okay.
Thank you for the call, Charles. You're listening to the voice of Governor Deval Patrick. He's here till the bottom of the hour, and by the way, at 2 o'clock we will bring you live the year-end press conference from the President of the United States from Washington.
Governor Steve Crosby, who heads the Gaming Commission, has been the subject of a lot of speculation and criticism because he waited a long time to disclose that he had business dealings. They were a while ago, 23 years ago, with one of the owners of the land in Everett that could, of course, be the casino. Now, he has recused himself from voting on that, and he's but many people think that he should be recusing himself from any kind of vote on any of the Boston area licenses, or even that he should be resigning because his commissionership has been tainted by this failure to disclose, as early as he might have. So I'm asking,
I was waiting for the question there. So
I'm asking so basically what you think. Does he have to recuse himself from the Boston vote? Does he have to recuse himself just from the land vote in which he's said he which he has done?
I think that question is between him and the Ethics Commission. I am satisfied with his recusing himself from the land vote. I think he has still yet to make a decision about whether he's going to recuse himself from all of it. I think it's it is an action he seems to be taking in an excess of caution, because the notion that a relationship that is 23 years stale, I'm not just talking, I mean, they haven't had a relationship for 23 years is, to me, it feels like a kind of an inflated concern. But to if I think he's taken the action he has taken in order to quiet people's concerns about optics, I think at the end of the day, substance is more important than optics. And substantively, I just don't from what I know. I'm not that worried about it.
Well, can I ask about optics and very quickly on this one? The Ethics Commission actually specifically said he did not have to recuse himself from the land vote, but he chose to anyway for appearance, for optics reasons. He's talked a lot about how appearance matters here. I asked him this the other night, and and I'm anxious to hear what you think, feel about it. Why does appearance matter on a land vote, but appearance does not matter on a more important vote, a final vote, as to whether or not Everett or potentially Revere or potentially nobody gets a casino in Eastern Mass?
So, Jim, what I was saying earlier, at least as I understand it, is that he hasn't made a decision
yet. Well, he says he will not, but I asked him the other day. He said that I could reconsider it, but as of now, he does not plan to recuse himself.
I mean, I would hate to think that the chair was missing from action in critical votes of the commission. The commission has a hugely important role, and we have a very, very thoughtful and I think effective chair. I'm not going to jump up and down if he recuses himself from the final vote, but based on what I know, I'm not troubled that if he votes. I get your point about if optics is important, but what I said a minute ago, I really believe. I get the importance of optics, but I think substance is more important. And if we gotta get this done and done right.
Well, that's the ballot question. You're aware of the fact that the Attorney General said the ballot question was unconstitutional to repeal the whole casino law that you signed. The SJC is going to rule on this in the interim. A judge has allowed them to collect signatures. They have gotten enough signatures to be on the ballot the same day we elect another governor. Martha Coakley, who at least as of the moment is the leading Democratic candidate, has said she's undecided as to whether or not she'll vote for repeal. Are you not worried as an advocate of this bill that when there's a lawsuit from Caesars, there may be a lawsuit from Revere if they don't get the casino, assuming they win their vote in February, and a ballot question hanging over? As a good business guy like this Wynn guy is, who's going to invest in a casino when come November, whatever it is, it's possible the whole thing disappears? Does that not worry you?
No, not really. That's why we have markets. The expansion of gaming is something I supported, but it's never been central to my economic growth strategy. I've heard loud and clear the concerns for people who think it's a bad idea for a whole host of reasons, and I've reflected on those concerns, and we've talked about a lot of them over the years, And on balance, I thought there was a right way and a wrong way to do this, and that the framework that's set out in the legislation, both the one I proposed and the one the speaker proposed and that we ultimately agreed on, is the right framework. If that framework means that people generally think expansion of gaming is okay, but they don't, but no community says I want it in my community, that may happen. That's within the framework. If it takes some time to sort out and settle the market before we get the level of investment that was forecast in the bill, that's okay. Mm-hmm. That's okay too. I'd like to get this done and resolved, but it is set up really to meaning the bill, the legislation is really set up to allow for this kind of yin and yang and working of it all out.
Governor, I just wonder if you talked to Steve Crosby about why it took him so long to disclose this relationship, even though it was 23 years ago.
Even to you.
Exactly. If you talked to him about why he didn't tell you about this.
You know, Frank, I got to go back to the you know, the materials that that he sent to me, but I don't feel like this is news for me. I think the question of whether he was going to participate in a vote that was involved a partial interest by somebody he knew 23 years ago is something he flagged early on. I wasn't concerned about it.
You knew it earlier than that.
I think so, but I have to go back and check my documents. I wasn't concerned about it. I'm still not concerned about it. And by the way, I'm not poo-pooing the folks who are concerned about it. I'm just saying, you know, 23 years ago is a long time ago not to have any. And, you know, as far as I can, as far as I have read, anyhow, the interest of the fellow he knew 20 or worked with 23 years ago is also quite small.
By the way, for the whatever it's worth, the Globe said he found out when he was touring the site in Everett with Wynn, maybe in November of last year, and he told you on August 22nd. That lag doesn't trouble you.
No.
Okay.
No, I'm not sure that's exactly right.
Okay. But, let's take another call, Governor, if we can squeeze another
homework.
One. He's Governor Deval Patrick. We're back to the phones.
Luke is calling from Framingham. Luke.
Hi, Luke.
Hi, Governor. Thank you for taking my call. Yeah,
thanks
it.
For holding.
My call is about the individual mandate here in Massachusetts and also as compared to federal counterpart.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering, from your point of view, whether there's a difference in terms of the Commonwealth legislative authority to enact that kind of an individual health care mandate as opposed to the congressional authority under which it was enacted. And also, relatedly, whether you have any insights from the operation of the individual mandate here in the Commonwealth over the past few years in terms of how you think the individual mandate on the federal level will play out.
Huh. So on the first question about the legislative authority, I'm a lawyer, but I don't play one on TV anymore. I think it was
the exercise of the taxing power on the federal level.
No, I know. I know. I mean, that's what the Supreme Court held,
Roberts,
right?
Yeah.
Correct, yeah.
Yeah.
Whereas they thought initially it would probably be like a Commerce Clause power. But the Commonwealth's legislature, of course, has more plenary police powers and other state-level powers that the Congress lacks. So I was just wondering whether you had any insights on that difference.
No, not really. I mean, most states have greater legislative latitude than the federal government does under the federal constitution. It's a kind of a moot or academic question at this point because we're not going to have two mandates. We're only going to have the federal one at this point. I will say, Luke, that if I understand it correctly, the way the federal mandate is charged is through the tax code, and the way the state mandate was charged for individuals was also through the tax code. I think I have that right, as opposed to the business one, which I think was more. I may be wrong about that actually, but anyhow.
Hope you're not looking to me for a legal opinion.
Yeah, somebody, is there
not
a lifeline?
Here. Not here.
Is there a lifeline?
No.
But continue.
But I guess I would. What I was going to say, I may be saying in a more general way. I feel like the state. Plan was simpler to explain to people and also to effectuate than the federal plan. But I understand why the federal plan is what it is. It is similar in a lot of ways. Sounds like you're very familiar with the two, but there was a lot more compromise, and you know, I want this sentence from this congressperson, the other one saying I want that sentence, than what happened in Massachusetts in 2006. So I'd say ours was a lot more straightforward. And the other benefit we have, which goes a little afield of your question, is that the broad coalition that invented healthcare reform in Massachusetts stuck together to refine it as we've gone along. And that's been enormously important because we've learned as we've gone along and we've needed to make changes to make it better.
Governor, Luke from Framingham, thank you for your call. You know, in a couple of minutes, I don't know if you know, we do a Friday news quiz every Friday, Governor. We've been trying to get you on the show for ages.
I'm sorry, my time is up.
No, but what we thought we'd do.
Thank you for having me.
It is the holiday.
Merry Christmas,
everybody. Is the holiday season. Keith Lockhart from the BSO is one of the, from the Boston Pops, is one of the participants. To get people in the mood, what we thought we'd do is we'd end this segment of Ask the Governor. A little quiz question for you. I can see you're pretty excited about that. Are you not?
Jim is very excited.
Okay, now here it is, Governor. Thank you
that
for agreeing to do
unlocked.
This. We're going to play something for you, and we want you to tell us, want you to listen to it. Tell us why these two things are in the news. You ready, Governor?
Okay.
Okay, here they are. Please play them for the Governor, if you would.
And the winner is...
Okay, now, here it is. The question again, Governor, is... We repeat the question on the quiz. Are these two things in the news?
So, because they are the competing songs for rock song of the state.
Look
right
at this.
Is that right?
He was sure you would have no idea.
The whole staff said,
wrong.
Don't even ask him. The governor's going to know this in 2 seconds. I said, he is never going to know these two songs. Do you know what they are?
So one is Dream On.
Whoa, by
Aerosmith. By Aerosmith, the right. So
the other one's Roadrunner by a guy is local from Natick, Jonathan Richman. They were called the Modern Lovers. Now,
and the Aerosmith proponents didn't show up for the hearing.
Is that true?
I heard. Yes, and the people who proposed Aerosmith. And the proponents of the others and their fans apparently showed up.
You want to hear from one of the proponents? This may help you decide what to advocate for. Here's one of the proponents. You may know this guy. Here he is.
I have 25 days left in the legislature to try and move my bill along.
That particular person told us his remaining priority as legislator was to get. So which side
you
are you on,
You
got
to love it.
No, that's Marty Walsh,
I'm going to sign the bill that comes before me. But I do, you know, I do like radio. But when music comes on and Marjorie starts dancing, I think to myself, TV is missing something.
That's right. I tell you, I'm an undiscovered talent over here. I'm going to go on Dancing with the Stars. You can come with me, Governor.
If we can dance from our chairs.
Hey, Governor, we really appreciate your time. It's good to see you.
Welcome back
to the States.
I wish you a very joyful Christmas and a peaceful season, you and your listeners. And let us all hope for peace and blessings and wisdom in 2014.
Thank you. We share those thoughts. Thanks
so
much, Governor. We'll see you in January.
Enjoy the new year. Governor Deval Patrick joins us every month for Ask the Governor. Thanks again, Governor, for being here. When we come back, it is our news quiz, a special Pops Edition Year in Review Challenge with Keith Lockhart of the Boston Pops and WCRB's Brian McCreath. That's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.